Chris had a bit of a tight journey getting here, and we just about managed to get the technology to work. So you must be a real scientist to be able to get that to work. So,
thank you.
You're a doctor, I see.
Yes.
What are you a doctor in?
Theology.
Theology?
Yeah. I can heal your soul, not your body, sadly.
Okay. That's cool. Great. So I believe you've a presentation for us,
sure,
which we're going to see just now. And then there's the time for questions later on. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, good evening, everybody. I seem like I'm very echoey, but can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Excellent. Can I ask you a question first? Because you're going to be answering me some questions later on. Can you tell me if science is your thing? You either studied it at university, or you like studying it or reading about it. Hands up if science is really your thing. That's what makes you tick. Great. Fantastic. Hands up if you're more of a kind of artsy kind of person. You did an art subject and studied that at university. Good. Very good. Excellent. Well, you have a lot in common with my wife. My wife studied German and international studies at university, which sounds like 2 degrees, doesn't it? Because German and international studies, it's a very long ascription. But she only had about 3 to 4 hours of contact time with her lecturers at university. And so I, as a scientist studying chemistry with medicinal chemistry, had 35 hours of lectures. So I always thought that I should have got 10 degrees to her one. And she used to laugh at me because, obviously, I hadn't read the prospectus when I went to university. I hadn't realised that science students would actually have to work for their degrees, while art students would be given theirs for free. So, you know, kudos if you studied arts at university or you're thinking of studying arts at university. Young people, this is your moment. You know, have a think. Do you want to work hard or do you want to be given a degree for free? I'd like to encourage you to study science. I remember my first lecture at, actually, my first two lectures. My first lecture at university was physical chemistry. And the lecturer spent the whole time with his back to us writing, it seemed, one long equation on the board. And he had really thick glasses, so as he turned around, we weren't sure if he could see us. But a lot of us were in tears because we hadn't done enough maths to be ready for this course. The second lecture we had was our safety demonstration. And they showed us a video. And it was a great video because there was a girl who had forgotten to tie her hair back when she was lighting a Bunsen burner. And the Bunsen burner went up and so did her hair. And then the second one was of a guy who was doing a gas infusion experiment, but he'd forgotten to take his contact lenses out. And so his contact lens melded with his eyeball. And we left that lecture hall standing tall, thinking, we are really studying the right subjects here at university, because we could die for our subjects. This was going to cost us something. While my wife, the only thing she was going to die of was boredom studying international studies. So I'm a big fan of science. I think science is wonderful. And I'm delighted there are lots of you that are passionate about science here in the room. But I think a lot of people have the opinion that science is in conflict with Christianity. And hence the question that your team came up with. Has science made God irrelevant? I mean, the short answer, of course, is no. But I'll give you a little longer answer so that you can have something to get your teeth into. I'd like to suggest that behind that question, there are some wrong views about science and what science is and what science does. And I think there are also some wrong views about Christianity. Let's look at the wrong views about science first, then look at the wrong views about Christianity, and then try to look at a way that you can kind of put them together, and then I'll open it up for some questions. Well, some people argue that science really is all that matters. Science is the most important set of questions that you can possibly ask about the universe. And some philosophers actually believe that science is, I suppose, the only way that you can know truth. Now, both of these, I would say, are misconceptions. Let's look at the first one. Science is all that matters. You see, in order for science to operate, you need to have a certain set of assumptions. So let's take, for example, one of the key things that scientists do is make observations, right? They make observations about their experiments. Now, I suppose you need some kind of moral framework that reporting your observations accurately and honestly are important. Now, can science provide a moral framework that makes that, justifiable? Some would argue, well, of course science can provide a moral framework. People like Richard Dawkins, for example, and we're bound to talk about him a bit tonight. He was an Oxford professor of zoology to begin with. His argument is that the universe is basically made up of blind, pitiless indifference. And the universe doesn't really care about good or bad. That is all just a matter of chance. So how do you build a moral framework if there is no moral framework to the universe? Can science provide the moral framework that makes accurate reporting useful, important, worth trusting? Because sadly, there are plenty of examples where people have fabricated their results, sometimes around cloning that came recently. We've seen some science used badly recently in Lance Armstrong's doping case that came out today. Science was being used, but we would argue in an unethical way to cheat. So can science provide a moral framework that will justify its existence, that will help us to know that accurate reporting has taken place? Or can science give us a reason why we should conduct science, or which science we should conduct? When I was studying medicinal chemistry, I got really interested in malaria. And malaria is a huge killer of people across the world. But the funding for malaria research is very small compared to the funding for AIDS research. Now, AIDS is killing a lot of people too, but AIDS is also a first world problem, not just a two-thirds world problem like malaria. Very few people in the Western world die of malaria. So guess where the money's going? Guess where the research money is? The research money is in AIDS rather than in malaria. Now, again, science is not operating on its own. It's operating within a political and economic framework, isn't it? So science is not pure science because the funding for science is being determined by another set of values. Where do those values come from? Well, let me move on to this second point. Science is the only way to truth. All other forms of knowledge are somehow secondary or inferior. I'll get you to do a bit of work now. I'm going to put up a quotation from a group called the Vienna Circle. And they were a bunch of empiricists that argued this case, that only science is a possible way to truth. And as I put it up, I would like to ask you to explore it. And maybe, if you're feeling friendly, talk to your neighbour about this. How do you feel about this statement? Are there any flaws in this statement as a philosophical statement? Let's see if it's going to come up here. Here we go. Okay, so this was called the verifiability criterion of meaning, which said this: no statement is meaningful unless it is possible, at least in principle, to verify it empirically. In other words, to do experiments on it and to prove that that is therefore true. Have a little chat with your neighbour. If you're not used to talking with your neighbour, now is a great chance to say, hello, where are you from? Like your colour of your jumper. And then if you fancy discussing the topic, then have a little go. I'll give you a couple of minutes to do that. Let's talk together. Anyone want to make some comments about this statement? Science is all that matters because science does empirical research, so therefore science is the way that we can know truth. And here is the philosophical statement that undergirds that philosophy. Who would like to comment on that as a statement? There's a gentleman there with a microphone.
Hello, good evening. My name's Daniela Panni.
I'm
Roman Catholic. My friend's part of the New Christian.
Great. Oh, good to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Hello, thank you. I believe that there is a sixth sense.
Okay.
Do you believe in God? I believe that God guides you.
Yeah. So your experience is telling you something else to this statement. Is that what I'm reading?
I believe that human beings have a sixth sense,
okay,
which is kind of a telepathic synchronization to another human, for example. Say, for example, your wife, husband are thinking of each other at the same time, and there is a telepathic wave across the... This is why we have telephones, and I don't know if you could say it's God or if it's science, or whether we've got a sixth sense, which is telepathic waves.
Interesting. Okay, thank you for sharing that.
Thank
Very
you.
Helpful. I'll try and bring that up later in the evening. Anyone else got a comment about our statement here? Oh, do you want to come here so they can hear you? I could just about make you out. There's a microphone coming, sir.
Does science have to justify that statement?
Well, that's a really interesting question. How would you prove that statement empirically? What experiment would you need to do to prove that statement? In one sense, it's a self-defeating statement, isn't it? Because there is no empirical experiment that you could do to prove that. Does that make sense? So you could say no statement except this one is meaningful unless it is possible, at least in principle, to verify it empirically. Does that make sense? It's a self-defeating statement.
I just can't see why science has to be justified.
Oh, you can't see why science has to be justified?
You're suggesting that science has to be looking for a truth.
Yes.
I'm just saying that science is just looking for facts.
Okay.
If you're looking for something beyond that.
Right, okay, well, I guess what the scientists were saying is the only thing that matters in the universe are things that you can prove experimentally. Okay, that's the statement some people believe. But let's take something else, for example. So some people would say, well, if only science is important, then, for example, beauty or art is not important. So, okay, you could describe a painting by... let's say Monet, as I suppose some carbon-based chemicals splattered over a canvas. That is one level of analysis of that painting. But have you captured that painting by describing it by its constituent parts? I would say no, there's another level of appreciation that you can give of it. It's actually this this Monet is a picture that's capturing something that you can't translate into words. And does that make it less true, less real for somebody? So all I'm saying is the scientists would sometimes try to reduce things down to what can be put into a test tube and analysed. And I'm saying actually that's not a fair description of the universe. Let me give you a silly example. So someone once defined a kiss as the meeting of two mouths with the mutual exchange of microbes and saliva. Is that an accurate description of a kiss? Yes. Is that all a kiss is? No. Sounds like that person hasn't enjoyed a kiss in a while. Or let's take my... I had a chemistry professor, and he was amazing. Some of you might remember these adverts, 118, 118. It had these guys with little kind of white vests running. They modelled that on my chemistry professor. He used to go and do that in the lunch break, and then we'd have a tutorial straight afterwards, and he'd leave his stinking... vest on the radiator, filling the room with the pungent aroma. And interestingly, his study, his area of study was pheromones, so how we smell. And his theory was that love is a chemical reaction. And you don't see someone across a crowded dance floor or disco or church, wherever you tend to hang out and meet the opposite sex. You don't see someone across that crowded dance floor. You smell someone across a crowded dance floor. And your brain is doing a bit of computation to find out who in the room are you the best genetic match with. Who will you be able to produce the best offspring with that are more likely to survive than others? Are you with me? And so he had a cunning plan. He had a little crush on Claudia Schiffer, who was a supermodel back in the day. I haven't seen her in a while, so I don't know how she's doing. But she's probably still as lovely as ever inside, which is what really counts. Let's just say that. So he had a crush on Claudia Schiffer, and he thought, you know, if I could find out a bit about her genetics, I could then manufacture a smell that I could spray on me, and I would then become irresistible to her, because it's not about how I look, it's not about how I talk, it's about how I smell. Are you with me? The guys that made Lynx got the same idea, if you've seen those adverts, that's their idea. Now, how do you feel about that as a definition of love? That all it is a chemical reaction. Have they adequately defined love? Or have they reduced it to its barest essentials? Have they lost something in the process? So this idea that only statements are meaningful unless they are possible to verify them empirically is a self-defeating statement. So I think it leaves us a little bit of room to say there might be some other ways in which you can know things to be true. I'll give you a chance to ask some questions about that later if you want to. But let me push on. So we're arguing, no, science is important, it's wonderful, it's great, but it isn't all that matters. It isn't the only way that you can describe life, beauty, arts, existence. Science is, I would argue, not the only way to truth, and actually it can only get you into certain levels of truth, and we might want to explore that a little bit later as well. Here's another one. Science is totally objective. In other words, there is no, human element in science. We're just seeing the facts and responding to those facts and then discerning truths about the universe. Now, again, this sounds credible, but when you think about it, it doesn't actually ring true. Let's take something simple. So a lot of science, scientists argue, and most of them are scientists who haven't thought critically or philosophically about what they're doing. They would argue that what you do is you observe nature and then you make deductions about that. The problem is, how do you know what observations to make? How do you decide what is a meaningful observation? Let me give you an example. So say you were asked to measure the length of a piece of metal. Okay? Now, okay, so you note down the length of metal and you could maybe measure it out to nanometers. What are the other things you might choose to record along with that measurement of length? Well, you might choose to record temperature, because metals change shape at different temperatures, expansion and contraction, right? So you're going to measure temperature and the length. Okay, any other factors? Well, atmospheric pressure, possibly it's going to be minimal, but maybe it matters what atmospheric pressure it was when you made that recording. How about day of the week? Would that be important that you measured it on a Thursday? Is that an important observation or not so important? How about the color of the piece of metal? Would that make a difference? Would you need to record that? How about the position of the moon when you were making that observation? Would that matter? How about how Liverpool were performing in the Premiership? Would that be an important factor on the length? I hope not, says a lot of people, because they're my team and we're having a bad time of it. How about how the X Factor was getting on? Would those be important considerations on the length of the piece of metal? No, I would argue. But how do you know they're not? How can you possibly know that without having a theory that tells you what is significant and what is insignificant? Are you with me? You are not making a straight observation. You have a whole set of assumptions about what is important to record and what isn't. So actually you look at the universe through a set of lenses, a tradition that you've been brought up in. It could be the scientific tradition, or a set of values that you hold to be important. And that informs what you observe. So we are not a blank slate observing the universe. We come preloaded, thanks to our education, our experience, our culture, with what we consider to be significant, and that is what we record. So every observation comes theory laden. So there is, in some sense, some form of subjectivity involved. Last one. Science necessitates atheism. All good scientists will be atheists. Now, there's some empirical research that you could do on that one, couldn't you? Let's find out, is that true globally? Well, they did a study in North America, and they asked all the members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is the biggest grouping of scientists in America, do you believe in God or any higher power? Now, it was true that less scientists than proportionally than the general public believed in God or some higher power. But 51% of them did believe in God or some higher power. In North America, it was more like 90% of the general population believed in some kind of God or higher power. But 51% of scientists believed in God or some kind of higher power. So that's empirically not true, that science leads to atheism. How about philosophically? Is it philosophically true that science should lead to atheism? Let me give you a for instance. This is a silly example, so play along if you're feeling game. Okay, let's just assume a finite universe, okay? One that has boundaries. It isn't an infinite universe. And I want that circle, or that approximation to a circle, to represent the universe. And actually to represent not just the universe, but all the knowledge and information that exists in the universe. Are you with me? Okay. Now, again, you can discuss this with your neighbour if you like. If you were to draw a circle that describes your knowledge of the universe, what size circle would you like to draw inside that circle? Okay? And you can have a chat with your neighbour on that one. See, you want to describe it, you can tell it in any way that you feel fit. How would you describe your knowledge of the universe? Want to be brave and tell us the size? Put your hand up if you've got a measurement or a description of your circle of knowledge. Yes. It would be so small that you'd need a huge microscope to see it. Can I depict that? Like that. Okay, anyone want to up that or lower that? How would you like to describe your circle of knowledge? Yeah. Yes. Pretty tiny. So you want to go even smaller than the lady here. This is like a humility contest, which is fantastic. That lady's pretty humble, but you're even more humble, which is great. So it's tiny, isn't it? Okay. So here's the killer question. Okay. If that is, let's say, our knowledge. I mean, let's be collective in the whole room, not just you on your own, but all of us put together. That is our knowledge of the universe. What can you tell me definitively about all this? What can you say about it? What have you just told me you can say about it? That you know absolutely nothing about it. Is that fair? All right, here's the interesting question. Most scientists are pretty humble people, aren't they? Because the more you find out about the subject, the more you know you don't know. That's also the experience of most undergraduates when they hit finalists. Their final exams. You know, oh man, I know nothing. I've got nothing. So if you can tell me that you know nothing about 99.999% of the universe, how can you definitively say there is no God? Are you with me? That would be a really tough thing to say, that there is no God, even though you know so little about the universe. Are you with me? I don't think science necessitates atheism. It could lead you to agnosticism, which is different. Agnosticism is actually, you know, means not, and gnosis means knowledge. So agnosticism means I have no knowledge. Okay, I'm not sure. That would be the more humble position to say, I'm not sure, but I don't think there's a God. You could say that at most. But to say definitively there is no God, that's making a definitive statement about the 99.99% of the universe that you know nothing about. Let's play it again. You remember there was a, well, how could you prove this statement? Okay, I want you to imagine that in Reading, there is a man called Bob. Okay? Let's try it the other way. How could you prove that in Reading tonight, there is not a man called Bob? Let's call it the Bob delusion. Okay, how could you prove definitively there isn't a man called Bob in Reading tonight? What would you need to do? How would you do it? How would you prove definitively there wasn't a man called Bob? You'd have to go around and talk to everybody, wouldn't you? Okay? Directory inquiries and just look through there. I mean, he might be ex-directory, then you're a bit stuck, aren't you? Okay, so you could directory inquiries, you could go door to door. You could start with the assumption that Bob is a nickname, thank you. A man known by the name of Bob, would you like that? Is that more accurate? How would you do it? Because while you were looking in one side of Reading, he might be the other side. And when you're over that side, he might be there. It'd be really difficult to prove definitively there isn't a man called Bob. Are you with me? Let's try it the other way. How could you demonstrate there was a man called Bob? What would you need to do? You just need to find one. One instance of a man called Bob and you're sorted. Let's try. Is there anyone called Bob in the room that can put us out of our misery? No, okay, fair enough. To prove definitively there isn't something is really tough. Because you actually need some kind of total knowledge, don't you, in order to be able to do that. You need to have searched every speck of the universe. But to demonstrate that there is a positive, you just need one example. Are you with me? It's a bit like the black swan. Okay, let's imagine that you've never seen a black swan. To prove that there isn't a black swan would be hard. You'd have to go look everywhere. But to prove there was a black swan, you just need one sighting, one credible sighting of a black swan. And actually, you don't need to have seen that yourself. Someone else that you trust might have seen it. A good bit of observation might have taken place. So Christians are saying, look, you know, we think science is brilliant. It's important. It's significant. But it's not all that matters. We think science is a valid way of knowing things about the universe, but it isn't the only way to know things about the universe. We think science helps us in all sorts of ways, but don't make the claim that it is totally objective. It can't be, because we're involved. Us subjective human beings have some involvement in it. And we come to the universe with a set of assumptions about what is important and what isn't. And we'd like to humbly say that science does not necessitate atheism. In fact, many Christians are happy to be scientists and Christians. So it doesn't necessitate one way or the other. But our statement was, does science make God irrelevant? And I've unpacked some of the false assumptions that some people have about science. I'd like to unpack some of the false assumptions that I think some people have about Christianity. Let's hope it fits on the screen. Okay, so the first one is this, that to be a Christian is an act of intellectual suicide. That in order to become a Christian, you're asked to disengage your brain and just believe. It's about as credible as believing in some great spaghetti monster in the sky. That Christianity is an infantile view, similar to children believing in the tooth fairy or something like that. You know, it's just something you grow up out of when you become mature and intellect. Now, I would like to argue that's not the case. That a key part of the Christian faith, in fact, Jesus said that the greatest commandment is that you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. The Christians believe that God is the author of your mind. He's the reason that you're able to think. And he doesn't want you to switch that off when you become a Christian. He wants you to turn it on. He wants you to think about things, explore things. In fact, a key part of our Christian heritage is that God invented human beings in order that we might cultivate the earth. And part of that was scientific exploration. In the early pages of Genesis, God commands to humans that they should name the animals, classify them, engage with them. They should go and find gold that's buried in the mountains. They should go and use their skills and their intellects to make something beautiful out of this beautiful planet. So God intended science to be part of that. You don't have to switch your brain off. But not everyone's happy with that. This is Richard Dawkins. He says this: faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. And so for some people, they've got this idea that faith is just a blind leap into the dark, that it's just closing your eyes and just hoping against hope that things are true. But that doesn't ring true with what Christianity claims about itself. Let me show you. This is a quote from... Oh, here we go. This is a quote from Jesus. And it's from John chapter 14. John's a biography of Jesus, written by a close friend of his, while memory about Jesus was still very prevalent. So it was written in the living memory of people. I'm sorry, it's kind of fallen off the end here. So Jesus said this: I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Very happy to answer questions about that later. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. Philip, one of Jesus' disciples, said, Lord, show us the Father and that will be enough for us. Jesus answered, don't you know me, Philip, even after I've been among you such a long time? Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. In other words, if you've seen Jesus, you've seen what God is like. How can you say, show us the Father? Here's the kicker, verses 10 and 11. Don't you believe that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words I say to you are not just my own. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the miracles themselves. What's Jesus asking his disciples to do? Is he saying, close your eyes, just hope that I'm the Messiah, I'm the promised one, I'm God in human form, just hope against hope that's true? No, he's saying, I want you to be reflective. I want you to look at what I've done, what you've witnessed with your eyes, what you've touched with your fingers, what you've seen. Trust what I say because of the evidence of the miracles themselves. Let me show you what this could mean. Did anyone have to cross a road today? Hands up, you crossed a road. That was you. Great, good. That was a very dangerous thing to do, wasn't it? Particularly in Reading. It's quite busy around here. Now, can you ever be philosophically certain that you're going to get to the other side when you cross a road? Absolutely, philosophically, 100%, irrefutably certain that you're going to make it from here to the other side? Who says no? I say no. I don't think you can be certain. So some people say, well, because you can't be philosophically certain, you're basically taking a blind leap into the unknown. But that would mean you would stick your fingers in your ears, close your eyes, scream at the top of your voice, and just run for it and hope that nothing hits you. Can't be philosophically certain. That's all you've got, the blind leap. That's all there is. Well, I don't think that's how we probably cross the road, is it? When I crossed the road, I was taught the Green Cross Code by Darth Vader, Peter Purvis. And he came to my school, actually. He did this amazing thing with his pectoral muscles. He could make them move. It was a beautiful, beautiful moment. But he wouldn't sign my Star Wars calendar, which I was a bit disappointed about. But, what you do, you stand at the side of the road, you gather evidence, you get your senses going, you make predictions about the speed of cars and your speed of travel. You cannot be philosophically certain because you could step out into the road and there might be some super glue left in the road. And there just might happen to be a steamroller inching its way down your road. That is a possibility, isn't it? Can't be philosophically certain. So what do? You make your best judgment, you gather your evidence, and then you step out. And that step out is a step of faith. It's not blind faith. It's faith based on the evidence that you've received. It's risky. You're risking your life on this one, aren't you? But you step out on the evidence that you've got. And when Jesus calls people to faith, he doesn't say, look, turn your brain off. Just become a cabbage for Jesus. He says, no, look, believe. Believe why? Believe because of what you've seen me do and say. Trust me because the evidence points that way. Now, you might want to ask me about whether miracles fit within a scientific framework. I'm really open to that as a conversation later. But let's go back to these again. Christianity is intellectual suicide. Christianity is a blind leap of faith. Christianity is anti-science. I think that's untrue historically. There was a huge study by a guy called Needham, who was a Marxist. And he went to study why it was that China, which was one of the leading kind of technological movements of its day, why it was that China was outstripped by the West in terms of scientific progress. Why did science flourish under the Enlightenment in Western Europe in a way that it didn't in the China of its day? He was a Marxist, no belief in God at all. But he came to the conclusion that the reason science flourished in the West was because there was a worldview, a view of the world, that said there was an intelligent person behind it. That the universe was worth exploring because there was a God who made it. And actually, historically, that's true as well. The founding of the Royal Society, one of the earliest scientific institutions in the world, in the 17th century, it was founded by people who believed that there were two books through which we could know things about God. There was the book of the Bible, and there was the book of nature. And the earliest scientists within the European tradition believed that they were thinking God's thoughts after him by exploring the universe. Let me give you, for instance, you know, you could probably program a computer quite easily to generate random numbers and random letters. I could probably do it as well. I used to be able to program in BASIC back in the day, and I could probably fill a screen with random ASCII letters. Now, would that random mess be worth reading and analysing? Imagine that you were set that as a GCSE question. You know, look for the, the themes coming out of this random piece of text. Would that be worth reading? Well, no, by very definition, it's random. So there's no meaning, there's no purpose, there's no pattern to be read. It's random. But if I took those same ASCII characters and I typed an email to you, it will appear on the same screen, the same letters, but why are they worth reading? They are, well, hopefully they're worth reading, because a mind has ordered those letters so that they communicate something. Now, the earliest scientists within the Royal Society were saying, well, the universe is not blind, chaotic chance. Or as Needham observed in some parts of China, the universe is not bouncing along on the back of a dragon. Christians believe that there was a God that made the universe, and he was trying to communicate to us through it. It was ordered by a mind, and therefore, it would be worth exploring. So actually, Christianity provided the framework in which science flourished in the Western world. There wasn't an opposition. They were partners through which we came to understand more about God and his universe. So, okay, how do we reconcile these two? Thank you. Why are you doing that? Let me give you a couple more. Oh, hold on. A couple more quotes, and then I'll let you ask some questions. I'd like to argue that Christianity and science are not mortal enemies, but actually fantastic partners. And one way you could see how they could relate together is a little bit like this. Imagine that we took a national geological survey map of Reading. Okay? What would be included on that map? A physical map of Reading. It will tell you the heights of certain hills. It will tell you the lows of certain valleys. It will show you where the rivers are. That's a useful map, particularly if you're orienteering. But if I took a political map of Reading, what would that show you? It would show you the constitutional boundaries, wouldn't it? Where the different constituencies in the elections are, where the different boroughs overlap. Now, of those two maps, which is the true map of Reading? Because if you walked along the road, you wouldn't bump into the kind of constituency boundary, would you? You wouldn't fall over it. It's a bit like going to look for the equator. You know, it's not really there. You don't fall over it. So which is the true map? Must be the physical one, right? That's the only true map of this situation. No. We would say both maps are useful depending on what questions you're trying to answer. They are complementary maps of the same reality. I would argue that Christianity and science offer complementary descriptions of the same reality. I was dating when I was at university, and my wife, who didn't have anything to do because she was doing an art subject, she wasn't my wife then. She wasn't even quite my girlfriend then, but I had intentions on her. And imagine that I'd invited her into my lab, just a chemistry lab. And, you know, as she came in, she saw that I'd left a tripod, Bunsen burner, a conical flask, and a liquid boiling away. And on the desk, I have written this question: why is this burning? Sorry, why is this boiling? And she's an art student, but she's done a little bit of scientific research, and she begins to write a paper just for me. She loves me. She just doesn't know it yet. And she says, it's boiling because it's the transfer of heat energy, and you're exciting the molecules inside the liquid, and the liquid is kind of reaching a moment when the molecules are transferring from being a liquid to a gas, and that is why this is boiling. Now, that is true to a certain degree. But then she says to me, but I say to her, actually, it's boiling because I wanted to make you a cup of coffee. Which is the true explanation of that experiment? No amount of observation would be able to tell you the purpose for which I set up that experiment. She couldn't know that. There's not enough information there. I'm answering at a higher level, as it were, than is just observable with the naked eye. She can't notice purpose. You can't see it from where she's looking. I can tell you that because I set the thing up. Christianity and science, what are they doing? Well, in one sense, science is answering at a very basic level the how question. How do things normally operate in the universe? How did God set things up? How are things going on? How do reactions take place? How can we make use of it? You know, technologically, we can come up with some good technical applications. How questions. At another level, God is answering the question, why? Why did I set the universe up? What is my intention for human life? What are you here for? What is your purpose? What are you supposed to do with all this technology? What are you supposed to do with your scientific research? They are not contradictory maps. They're not contradictory explanations. They're complementary. One last one. Do you know who killed Sherlock Holmes? Who killed Sherlock Holmes? Apparently it was Professor Moriarty. Is that the only possible answer to that question? Could you say Sir Arthur Conan Doyle killed Sherlock Holmes? Which is the true answer? Depends what question you're asking. Why does an apple drop when you let go of it? Gravity, for sure. But is it also possible to describe that because God set up gravity to do that? Yes, that's another level of description. Christianity allows you to ask more questions, actually. Imagine this. My daughter and I, we were watching some meteorites go over the earth and just kind of burn up into the atmosphere. It was a beautiful night. My boys didn't want to do it. They were asleep. Daddy let us sleep. It was like midnight, but I got my daughter up, wrapped her in a sleeping bag, got a mug of hot chocolate for me and one for her. We sat out and we watched this thing, and it was beautiful. It was a great bonding moment. We loved it. Thank you, science, for making it possible for us to predict that was going to happen that night. Wonderful. Now, my little daughter's looking up, and she says, Daddy, Daddy, why are the stars burning? And I say, well, it's because they're balls of gas burning billions of miles away. Yes, 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 Daddy, but why are there balls of gas burning billions of miles away? Well, it's because there was a Big Bang, and there was a set of initial conditions, and the Big Bang exploded across the universe, and that's what we've got now, and that's where it is. Yes, yes, but Daddy, Daddy, why was there a Big Bang? Good question, daughter of mine. It's because there were a set of initial conditions that were just right that allowed the universe to take place. Okay, but why were there a set of initial conditions? Well, because of the laws of physics. Yes, but Daddy, Daddy, why are there laws of physics? Well, there just are. You run out of answers somewhere. You need a starting point to begin your study. Science makes that statement. Somewhere along the lines, you need to say, well, it just was. That's just the way it is. I don't know. Now, Christianity asks one more question. Daddy, Daddy, why are there laws of physics? Because God made the laws of physics. But Daddy, Daddy, where did God come from? Well, he just was and always will be. Now, some people say, oh, look, now you've committed intellectual suicide. You've not given an adequate foundation for your belief in God. Well, hold on. There just are laws of physics. That's no better starting point. You have to start somewhere. Christianity asks one more question and says, God is the one that made this universe. You might then ask yourself, well, which one gives a better description of the reality in which we live? The fullness of life, purpose and meaning and morality. Which one gives a better description of that? I would argue Christianity does, but I'm sure some of you will have some great questions to throw back at me. So let's pause there to give you a chance to do that. If you are feeling techie, then feel free to text them in. But let me just give you a minute. You might want to talk with your neighbor. You might want to write something down. And we'll just take a break for you to do that. And then the free-for-all for questions begin until I need to get on a train back home. But have a chat with your neighbor. Text in. Write some more. And then we'll pause and start to ask those questions.
Just to get you warmed up, here's one that's been texted in. You might want to listen to. I hope Chris is ready for this one. Does the speaker agree with Gödel's second theorem that no mathematical system can prove its own consistency? And if you apply this to mathematical science, it cannot prove that science is any more than an alternative system of faith.
Yes.
You do agree.
Yeah. It's Gödel's theory. So it's kind of a little bit like that idea that you can't answer all the questions within the framework that you're answering. So it's similar to the one that I was telling you about, the observation of why is this boiling. You need another level of description to understand what's going on. But I'm no mathematician, so over to the mathematician in the room that raised that one. It was a good comment.
Does anybody...
Okay, sir. Can we have a microphone over here, please?
I suppose when I think of Christians, one thing that they have to deal with is the apparent conflict,
yes,
on specific issues between what science states and what the scriptures appear to state.
Hmm.
Now, the obvious one is longevity, the ages,
yes,
of,
yes,
the universe.
Yes, the age of the universe or the age of people of the universe?
Not so many people. If, okay, you see the many programs on,
yes,
after the Big Bang,
sure,
before the Big Bang,
yeah,
I mean, that happened thousands of millions,
sure,
of years,
sure,
ago.
Okay.
How does that compare with what, in the sense that we have, how long ago the universe was,
okay,
created in Genesis?
Let me put a bit of a framework on that one. So every Christian must believe, following the scriptures, that God created the universe. That's a kind of given, isn't it? It's hard, I'd say impossible, to be a Christian and not believe that God created the universe. The speed in which he did it and the mechanism which he used to do it is debatable. And there are Christians on kind of two sides of a major camp here. So one group, as they read the opening chapters of Genesis, argue that to be true to Scripture, you need to believe that God created the world in 6 literal days. And that took place, when you add up all the genealogies together, about 6,000 years ago. Okay? That's one school. Another school says God created the universe, but when you read Genesis, it doesn't necessitate that view. The story of creation is being told poetically in a form that matches 6 days of a week, but God didn't do it in 6 days. He just told Moses about it, or he's explaining it in 6 days of a week. Now, for me, that's a bit of an internal debate between members of the church. The most important thing for me as a Christian is I want to believe what the Bible definitely teaches, and it definitely teaches that God created the universe. God is more than capable of creating the universe in 6 microseconds, let alone 6,000 years. So it's not about the length. It's just about the fact that God created it. So I'm pretty relaxed about that one. It's not a question I'll be willing to go to the stake to die for, about which side you land on that one. But I do want to say it is a fundamental belief of the Christian faith that God created the universe, and he did it in his own time, in his own way. So can I leave it there? And if you want to kind of come back at me later, we're happy to kind of address it. Thank you.
We've got another question over here. We've got a microphone, Nick, if you'd like to bring the microphone up to the front here. Thank you.
Hello, Krish. My name's Paul. You've talked about meaning and finding meaning in God and so on. What about the thought that says that the reason that we believe in God is because of our need to find meaning, because the idea that the universe is utterly random and utterly meaningless is too unpleasant a thought?
Yes. That's a good question, Paul. The problem with it is it works both ways. So some would say Christians are just not brave enough to take the universe as it is, that it's blind, pitiless indifference and you just got to live with it. But in order to kind of cope with that, we've constructed a meaning and imposed that on the universe, and we've invented God, you know, the kind of projection theory, what we really want there to be. But similarly, someone could argue about actually atheists can't cope with the idea of accountability and having to give an account for moral decisions that we've made. So rather than take the reality of God, we've denied his existence. So you kind of, you know, tit for tat, it doesn't really get you anywhere. And that's where I would argue that my route to faith personally probably involved three different things. They all begin with E, which may be useful. So one is an experience. So many people would point to an experience of God in their life in some way. And for some people, that's an experience of nature. I've met people that said, I just stood there, I held a baby in my arms for the first time, and I just knew there was more to life than this. Or other people, they're out surfing, and they just catch an amazing wave, and they just felt connected to something bigger. Or it's a sunset. For other people, it's actually someone prayed for me and I had an experience of God. Or someone prayed for me and I was healed. There's all sorts of different experiences that have been, for some people, a way into God. Experience is hard to refute. Because if you say, I've had an experience, and I say, no, you haven't. Well, how can I know your experience better than you? So experience is hard to refute. But the other problem is experience is hard to transfer. If you haven't had that experience, what do? You're a bit kind of stuck. So experience is one route in. Another route in is what I'd call explanatory power. So we need to be able to explain with the theory that we hold about the universe as much as we can. And I think a framework that completely rules God out has some big questions to ask about meaning, about morality, about things like, why does science work, for example? How come our brains are capable of decoding what's going on in the universe? That's an amazing coincidence. You know, that's incredible in itself. You know, what is information? Information's kind of invisible. How do we kind of understand it? How do we relate to it? Christianity would argue, actually, God is the logos. He is the one that speaks meaning, purpose, information into the universe. It would be empty otherwise. So, explanatory power. Does your way of understanding the universe cover all of your experiences of life as you know it? And the third one is evidence. And for me, the historical evidence that supports Jesus' life, death, and particularly his resurrection, for me, are reasons I believe. Now, you might say, oh, historical evidence, well, you can't put that in a test tube and kind of, test it. And I'll say, exactly. Historical information doesn't work like that. You've got to go on things like credibility of sources and reasons and motivations for people to lie. So I would say experience, evidence, and explanatory power are my three ways in. And maybe that kind of undercuts that you just have to believe because you have to, because you can always come back and say, well, you have to believe there isn't a God because you can't cope with accountability. That's a long answer to a short question, but I hope that helped. Yeah, you have another?
I've got one here which is coming through on the text line.
Cool.
Which really, it starts off with, or asks that same question,
yeah,
about evidence.
Yes.
But then it says, when should you make that step of faith?
Right. Good. So I don't think it's possible to know something beyond all possible doubt, okay? But I do think you can get to a point where you can trust something beyond reasonable doubt. Let me give you an example. What's your name again? Paul. How would you prove to this room that you had breakfast this morning?
I can't.
A stool sample. Thank you for lowering the tone of this otherwise very friendly debate. A stool sample. Now, I'm not sufficiently biochemically trained to be able to analyse a stool sample. So you might send it off to a lab somewhere, mightn't you, to give them get expert opinion. But hold on, you know, you could have bribed that lab to come up with a positive result that you had Shreddies this morning. Is there any other way that you could prove that he had breakfast this morning? Okay, or you could ask his wife or his children. Were there any witnesses to this event? And
no,
you have corroborating testimony, okay?
No, there wasn't, sorry.
But there wasn't,
no,
okay.
No.
But even if you had, is it still possible that they would say that, wouldn't they? They'll always back up what you say because they trust you. Okay. Any other ways you could prove that this man had breakfast? Stomach scan, CCTV, all of those things. But is it possible that all of those were forged? So CCTV camera, he could have been really clever with a bit of, you know, video editing, and it's actually yesterday's breakfast, not today's breakfast. Or stomach scan, again, you know, I can't interpret a stomach scan, so you might have asked an expert. Do you see, it is possible, no matter how much evidence you put in front of me, that I could hold a cynical view and refuse to believe. But that amount of disbelief about a relatively mundane thing is an unreasonable amount of cynicism. Are you with me? I don't think you can prove something beyond all possible doubt, but you can come to the point where you trust something beyond reasonable doubt. The other way of looking at it is this. Some people say, look, I'm agnostic. I don't believe there is a God. I'm not sure there isn't. So I'm just kind of sitting on the fence. The problem is every day, you and I, we make decisions. We make decisions about what we do, about who we see, about how we spend money, about what we study for or what we work hard for. Now, those decisions are commitments to a certain view. If you believe there is no God, for example, and you believe that the highest good, and not all atheists do, the highest good is personal fulfillment, and so you live a life of blatant consumerism that's all about you, you're not agnostic. You're committed to a way of living. Does that make sense? You're committed to a way of living that excludes God. So actually, in one sense, you might be theoretically agnostic, but practically, you're committed to something. What's even more scary is that some people are theoretically Christian, but practically atheists. So they might say they hold to belief in God, but their lifestyles actually betray their true beliefs, that actually they're living for themselves just as much as anybody else's. And actually, some atheists are theoretically atheist, but very moral and actually Christian practically. Does that make sense? And so, you know, this is where things get a little bit tricky. So I would say, look, let me give you one, for instance. Talking a lot about my wife, she'll love that. I got married, and the day before, my whole family were staying in a hotel that was also a cattery. Don't ask me. It was cheap, and we're Asian, and that's the way we roll. Anyway, so this cattery hotel thing, we were all staying there. Me, my mum, my dad, my sister, my aunties, and my grandmother, my nan. And in the middle of the night, my nan wakes up screaming one word. No! And that kind of freaked me out a little bit. And I couldn't get back to sleep after that. And I'm beginning to say to myself, oh my goodness, what am I doing? You know, do I know her well enough that I'm committing forever? I'm making some pretty big promises. Till death do us part, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse. That's a big promise. And my grandmother's just screamed out no in the middle of the night. And oh my goodness. And, you know, what about if we can't have kids? You know, well, that could be really difficult. We'll be able to cope. Or what about if we felt, you know, callings in different directions in terms of our vocations in life? And, well, you know, she might be called to Chile and I might be called to Hawaii. And, you know, how would we decide and how would we make those big decisions? Oh, I'm not sure. I need some proof. Now, at that moment, I had no way of getting any more information. They're all unknown questions, weren't they? Now, in one sense, some people put off commitment forever because they don't know the right answers. But what I needed to do at that moment is I rewound in my head everything I knew about my fiance. And I began to reflect on her character and what she was like and how we'd known each other and how she treated her friends and family. And I thought, you know what? I don't know all the answers, but I trust her enough that we'll work it out. And so the next morning, somewhat bleary-eyed, we all got up, we went to the church, we got married, we promised forever. 18 years, we're still doing okay, praise the Lord. Now look, with God, can you ever know for certain? Will you ever have all your answers, all your questions answered? No. I've been a Christian since I was about 15 years old, and I've got more questions now than I had before. But every time I'm worried, I'm questioning, I have doubts, I rewind in my head, what do I know for sure about God? And for me, the key thing is God loves us. He demonstrated that when Jesus lived the life that we should have lived and he died the death we should have died on the cross for our sins. And I look to that moment and I say, look, if God was willing to do that for me, I can trust him for all the rest. And so for me, that was the point I came. I came to a point of belief. I believe God beyond all reasonable doubt that you are who you say you are, what's revealed in the Bible is true, and you love me and you want a relationship with me and you want to be in my life helping me to show everyone possible the love of God, both locally, politically, globally. You want me to be involved in what you're doing. I'm in. And I'll work out the problems as we go. And so if you're at that point where you're thinking, oh, I've still got loads of questions, maybe rewind and say, well, what do you know for sure? Do you know enough about God to say, I don't have all the answers, but I know enough about you to trust you for the rest? That's when you're ready to make a commitment to God. Next question, if you like.
Is there a question from the floor?
Yeah, go for it.
Any more questions? No?
Yes, there's one there.
We've got one in the middle over here, so if we could have a mic. There's a mic on its way.
Yeah.
Actually, she's called Lynn, not Mike, but
Ha-ha.
Sorry.
It's good.
What is your views on Jesus being, you know, like a virgin birth?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good one.
Because as far as my knowledge is concerned,
yeah.
I read an article
in
the paper that, I forgot what island it is, where Darwin went.
Yes. Oh, the Galapagos Islands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a giant lizard there.
Uh-huh.
They do have virgin births.
Oh.
But they can only produce males.
Okay.
Not females.
Yeah.
Because their chromosomes are totally different than ours. So my reasoning is, where did Jesus get the extra chromosome from?
Oh, okay. That's probably beyond my field of expertise, chemistry, not biology. But let me give you a framework for working out miracle claims in the Bible. Maybe that will help us. So the virgin birth, the belief that Christians have that Jesus was not conceived through sexual intercourse between a man and a woman or between God and Mary, God miraculously impregnated Mary. And so he was the Son of God, truly God and truly human. Now, is that possible scientifically? Well, in one sense, no. And in fact, that's kind of the point. Science describes how things normally happen, okay? And it can describe the normal operation of the universe. And Christians would say that's how God normally sustains the universe. But the way that miracles function in the Gospels are a signpost to tell you that Jesus is not normal. He's God in human form. He's a supernatural being. So imagine this, and pay careful attention, because someone woke up in the middle of one of my talks and got the wrong end of the stick. So just hear me out. Imagine I was claiming to be God in human form. Imagine. Did you got that? Yeah. And I said, look, the reason you can know that I am God is because I'll show you this incredible thing. If I'm going to get a cup of hot coffee and I'm going to leave it on a table for 3 hours, And I'll prophesy over the coffee that in 3 hours it will be cold. Convincing? I mean, the prophecy will come true, but you have a framework that can explain why, due to the, you know, dissipation of heat and second law of thermodynamics and everything, that's why that's going to go cold. So if the virgin birth or the resurrection of Lazarus or Jesus' resurrection from the dead was scientifically explainable, that would defeat the object, wouldn't it? They are supposed to be God interrupting the way things normally happen in order to let us know he's there. Now, can science tell you categorically that miracles can't happen? No, science can only describe the things that the way things normally occur. The only way you can explore a miracle claim is to use historical research. And then you're not into repeatable events. So we're claiming these are unique events. They're not everyday repeatable events. It's not some magic spell. It's not some formula. These are historical events that point us to God and let us know he's really there. And so what you've then got to use is all the same resources that you'd use for any claim of a historical event. Were there witnesses? Are they reliable? Did they fabricate the story? How long after the event happened were things written down? Are there any corroborating manuscripts? What were the motivations for the people writing it? So you've got to put, as if you were putting someone in a dock, in a court, you've got to interrogate that evidence to see if it adds up. And for me, those twin things, that the miracles of Jesus have a function to show us who he is, and I believe they stand up to historical scrutiny. That's why I believe them. And I believe the virgin birth really happened. And I have no idea about the chromosomes or the Galapagos Islands, because the virgin birth is supposed to show you that Jesus is not one normally born, as it were. He is God in human form. But maybe someone wants to come back at that or ask a different question.
I think we've run out of time, actually.
No.
It's quarter to nine, so I don't know.
One last chance?
One last question.
You've had a chance, but we'll just check nobody else has got one. Otherwise, we'll very happily give you a second question. Okay, one last question from you.
Game between what we get from the scriptures.
Yes.
We believe in a God that is good and holy and compassionate.
Yes.
And yet, his creation as regards the sea is full of voracious cannibals.
Right. How do we refer that? Well, that's a good one. You know, imagine, well, there used to be an advert on television about this. So this guy has got a disaster of a... No, I'll tell you a different way. Okay. Imagine that you came into my house just after a burglar had ransacked the place. Okay? But you've come into my house and you look around how I've decorated the place and you go, I really don't like what you've done with your interior. You might make all sorts of assumptions about me as a person because of what you're experiencing. But you haven't allowed me to tell the story for why things are the way they are now. So Christians believe, look, the world here is not now as God originally intended it to be. It is a mixture of beauty and brokenness. So, you know, there are moments when you stand and you behold a starry night and you think, wow, that is just transcendent. I'm lifted out of this moment. I can't believe the beauty of it. It's overwhelmingly amazing. And there are other days you drive into London and the smog just hits you and you see all the litter everywhere and you say, oh, this is a cruel world. What a horrible place. So the world is not now as God intends it to be, but he's still got his fingerprints on it. In those moments of beauty, we see that. But when we see the brokenness of our world, that's not God's intention. That's part of God giving human beings the freedom of will to do more or less as we like. And we'll be accountable for that one day. But the universe now is not as God intends it to be. So earthquakes and famines and Ebola viruses, they're part of the way the world has been damaged by human intervention and human rebellion. And so that's why the world is not as it ought to be. Guys, I would love to talk to you more. I appreciate your time. And if you're someone here that's exploring the Christian faith, thank you for your patience and being willing to engage with this. I would say to you, look, what's the worst that could happen to you if you explore the Christian faith as an adult? Try to take off as much cynicism as possible and see if it makes sense. The worst that could happen is that you prove Christianity to be false. No great loss to you, okay? Because you might think it's false already. But if you discover it to be true, That there really is a God that loves you, that wants a relationship with you, wants you to be part of his great plan to transform the world so it brings glory to him. That is a treasure worth finding out. And so, you know, I just want to commend you. If you are someone here tonight that's come to explore it, well done for making that step. If there's anything that the churches in this area can do to help you with that, there's people that would love to answer your questions. I'm going to be around for the next 10 minutes, so please make a beeline for me to talk to me. And then I'm trying to get home tonight so I can be with my family tomorrow. But so someone kindly is going to take me to a station. But thank you for joining us. May God bless you and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you very much.